Based on the two sections, the first is kind of a review. Asymmetric quantum code constructions and discussions have been somewhat of a topic here and also at Georgia Tech. And so I'm going to just review and point out a few aspects about how you could construct asymmetric quantum codes. Then I'm going to use them, these constructions, in the second part of the talk. So the first part is kind of a review. We'll historically go back to, say, the Kaldemann, Schur, Steen, Rains, Sloan's papers, the 96 or so. And then I'm going to use that in adaptive error correction. And the basic idea is that we may want to settle on a certain code word and then the corresponding fault-tolerant operations that occur in a computation algorithm. But we want to kind of keep track of the syndromes and what's happening statistically. We may make a decision down the road that, well, our initial assumption for what bit flip distances or code flip distances we need to protect against error was too conservative. Those distances were too large. Can we kind of dynamically update the code if it's a programmable structure like an ion trap, and what that buys you? And it turns out that that buys you a substantial reduction of the complexity of the error correction stage. So you're really working towards trying to couple the error correction in a semi-dynamical fashion, and I'll define what I mean by semi-dynamical fashion later on, to what the underlying noise model is. And this is something that, you know, the inspiration for this is adaptive circuits are very common in classical signal processing. I mean, phase lock loops are a key component in anything where there's radio transmissions where you're trying to lock onto a frequency or do noise reduction, so on, et cetera. So, but kind of adaptive, figuring out what the noise levels are, doing some analysis on the system and trying to optimize it, at least in a semi-automated fashion, really hasn't shown up that much in quantum computation. So just some nomenclature to get going. You know, classically, we just have bit flips. Quantum mechanically, you have the bit flips and the phase flips. So we have assigned kind of a probability of a bit flip and a phase flip occurring. And then that gives us two code distances. So depending on how often we implement error correction, we want these code distances to be able to handle what we expect, worst case, the accumulations of bit flips and phase flips to that accumulate. For efficient error correction, we kind of want to design a code where the ratio or the relative weighting of the distances for bit flips and phase flips kind of respects the relative probability of how often the bit flips and phase flips occur. So how do we kind of design asymmetric codes like this? Well, first let's motivate it. So does this really happen? Do we have, you know, asymmetric codes? I mean, we're used to, say, the Steen code, which is equal distance for bit flips and phase flips, the Schur code. I mean, as we've heard in this workshop, there's plenty of codes kicking around. But, you know, how well or how offset or how asymmetric can real physical systems be? And does this kind of asymmetric code design, is it worthwhile? So in talking to Dick Slusher at Georgia Tech, you know, we've been talking about ion trap architectures, and he's kind of concerned about read-write operations, that there's a lot of phase noise on the laser. So he kind of thinks you might want to use a highly asymmetric code that is very robust and has a large distance for phase flips, but not necessarily that much of a distance for bit flips for the laser read-in or out. And then also, if you just have the ions and they're isolated and you're not really actively using them quite a lot, then the dominant form of decoherence is just this decay from the excited to the ground state, and that decay is described by the amplitude damping channel. So I'm going to talk a little bit about the amplitude damping channel. I mean, as you kind of tweak and play games with the apparatus, swap components out, components age, so on, et cetera, kind of the rate of spontaneous decay might be changing, and so I'm going to roughly use this in a hand-wavy fashion as kind of motivation for why you may be interested in trying to, you know, noise lock or determine what that current noise level is, kind of what the current level of spontaneous decay is, and try to optimize your error correction to that. So this is just kind of a graphic on amplitude damping. If we have the ground state up there, this is the block sphere with a unit radius. And the amplitude damping channel kind of shrinks this down, so that the ground state goes to the ground state, but the excited state kind of shrinks towards the ground state. This is kind of the Rutsky, King, Suarez, Werner kind of picture of a graphical picture of how single qubit channels behave. And so we can just see, and what I want you to kind of consider is that this is rotationally symmetric, this football here. So we would expect, in the end, we're going to calculate probability of x errors, y errors, and z errors for this amplitude damping spontaneous decay model. So we expect piece of x and piece of y to be equal, but piece of z to be different. So how do we calculate those probabilities? Okay, so we take the operator sum for the amplitude damping and skip giving the matrices. If there's no damping, block sphere of radius 1, just map to the block sphere of radius 1, and gamma 0. If everything shrinks to the ground state, it's full damping. So let's just consider using a Schur 9-qubit code, and let's just consider damping action on the first qubit only. So we have this as calculating the probability of an X flip. And I later found out this was a homework problem in your course, apparently, Professor Schur. So,
yes, it was.
I hope I got the same slots. it'd be embarrassing. So here's piece of x and piece of y as a function of damping parameter. Okay, this is the probability of these events occurring. This is the probability of piece of z. This is just the probability that it's the identity. So when there's no damping, you just obviously have the identity operation. No error occurs on the Schur code word going through. That's when we have full damping, everything kind of probability of x, y, z, and identity is a quarter.
But you have to use the right version of the Schur 9-bit code to get this.
Oh, okay. Well, I actually checked with your graduate student, Andrew Fletcher, just to speak a little bit. That really helped, apparently, you know, embarrassing myself with numbers, so I have semi-confidence. He wrote the solutions to your homework set. So for probability of a phase flip, you know, if a Y or a Z occurs, probability of a bit flips, just the sum X and Y, because we consider X, Y, and Z to be, you know, mutually exclusive events. And so we see here that, as the damping channel parameters swept or changed, I mean, there's quite a difference between what the probability of a bit flip is and a probability of a phase flip for any one damping parameter. And this kind of implies that, you know, if we really were interested in efficient code design, efficient asymmetric code design, and we would kind of want to tailor the distances of the code to respect these two probabilities. And in fact, I had earlier referred to the rough ratio of the distances with respect to what the ratio of the two probabilities are, bit flip to phase flip. So we see that for, you know, relatively small dampings, we want really a bit flip distance that's twice a phase flip distance. But when we go up to full damping, we, you know, out in this regime, we really want equal distance for a bit flip and phase flip. Okay. And these are just relative. I mean, the absolute distances are given by how often you error correct. So, you know, we're actually, you know, used to seeing, to some sense, asymmetric quantum codes. I mean, the bit flip code is something that everyone here is familiar with. And what might not be so commonly known is that in this paper, is the outline for a design process where if I would like to have an asymmetric code, how would I would go about actually constructing it within the CSS framework. So we already know pretty efficient ways on how to find the block length and asymmetric codes. We can't totally specify just arbitrarily what distances we want, but this framework here, the CSS framework that comes out of this paper, really gives us guidance into what's possible within a certain block length. And I'm going to just actually briefly review this kind of design process. So the idea comes about from this polynomial representation of classical cyclic codes. If I have a message polynomial, I'm going to add a code polynomial, so the coefficients here are binary, coefficients here are binary, and I generate the code polynomial from a message polynomial. And this, so this would be like X, this would be the C, and this G is the generated matrix, G is the C matrices. And so all of the properties of a certain code are all wrapped up in with this G sub S. Okay? And G sub S, so this is kind of a review, but if I want the code to be a linear cyclic code, okay, fall within the CSS construction, then I want g sub s to be a factor of this s to the n minus 1, where n is the block length. And so I factor s to the n in terms of the irreducible polynomials, and then I'll find that the two generated polynomials for the two code words, because I'm embedding c beta inside of c alpha, so this code is going to give me the phase width protection, and this code is going to give me the bit width protection. I must have that g alpha divides that. So this is all pretty much review, right? So I follow through down here, and I just construct this generator polynomial from one set of factors from g beta, this generator polynomial, another set of factors, irreducible factors, I get the distances. Okay? But the important thing here is, and the reason why I kind of went through all of this, although you guys all probably know this, is that I can go back and I can look at what the decomposition of what of a s to the n, you know, minus 1 is for different n. And if I get lots of different factors and I play games with the combination of these factors, I can generate lots of different codes of different different distances. For instance, I can have a bit flip distance here of 5 and a phase flip distance of 2 if I use this construction for the alpha code and the beta code. But then I can swap distance. I can actually take distance away from the bit flip code and I can give it to the phase flip code by just choosing a different factorization. And the argument I'm going to make in the adaptive portion of this talk is that I can do this in a fault-tolerant kind of dynamical way. I can choose a block length n. I can kind of look at the syndrome measurements, which are classical outcomes. I can decide, well, I need more phase width distance than bit width distance, and kind of getting close to, you know, dangerously close to the distance where I can't correct phase flips. And so I can kind of adjust the code and steal, you know, bit width distance and give it to phase width distance. And that's why I tormented you with this long math process. Okay. Once I know the CSS construction, I know the fault-tolerant encoded x and z operations, and I can just get that because I can get the stabilizer operators from the parity check matrix of c alpha and c beta, and then once I know that, I know the normalizer, I've got the stabilizer, I know what the other operations are. Okay, so I can kind of, I have this mental framework of how I'm going to construct asymmetric codes, and then how I'm going to construct the fault-tolerant gate operations, the x and the z, and so I'm all set for the second half of the talk. So this is work that's really already been done and kind of scattered around the literature. So any questions? Okay. So what do I want to do here? I want to start collecting statistics on the error correction stage. Okay? And again, the idea is that if I find from my syndrome outcomes that my error correction system is getting dangerously close or butting up against the overall, say, bit flip distance, I want to kind of expand that bit flip distance. And I'll have to change, if I change the code, as I had given the example before, I'm also going to have to change the fault-tolerant gate construction. The constructions that are in there, because I'm kind of changing the code, say, at this stage here. But really the whole idea, and what I'll justify this with in the end, is that I'm trying to keep kind of the code structure as closely tied to the noise level as possible. And kind of to leap a little bit to the end is that there's a big penalty. The complexity of kind of the error correction block grows quite rapidly with both n block length and and when I say grow, I mean in terms of the number of simultaneous qubits I have to make for a syndrome measurement and the number of syndromes that I have to calculate. Okay? So that's kind of what I want to minimize, the number of joint qubits in a syndrome measurement and the number of syndromes. And so what are the kind of adaptive code options that I can do? And I can figure out how to do all of these by just going back and looking at different factorizations of s to the n minus 1. I can vary n. I can vary how I put together the irreducible polynomials to construct codes. So I can increase or decrease the bit flip distance at the expense of the phase flip distance, so keeping the block length fixed. So that was the example that we gave in the first part of the talk. I can actually change the code word length. at the same time as shrinking or increasing these distances. Okay? I can keep the code word length constant, but I can change the number of encoded qubits, okay, by changing the rough distance per qubit. And I got a parenthesis here because I'm not really sure how useful this will be. I'm kind of swapping out and setting aside encoded qubits. But I'll just throw it up there as an option because there may be an application that would be useful to do. Or I can do kind of combinations of any of these. And so I can implement these degrees of freedom in this quantum code design, and I can understand this, manipulate this, so on, et cetera, using the outline, the techniques that the first half. So where would this technique kind of be useful? And so adaption quantum mechanically kind of works in the same regime as adaption in classical systems. You know, I have a certain gate time scale, and I want the noise variation time scale, how the bit width distance of the phase width distances are varying, that to be on a time scale that's much greater than the gate time scale. But at the same time, I want the noise variation time scale to be much less than the total execution time. So, you know, basically what I want to do is I want to not change the underlying code structure too often because there's an overhead associated with that, but often enough, so that's kind of where this inequality comes from, but often enough that I actually help my computation. And so that's where this inequality comes from. And also I may just want to just use different codes, and this again, like as a comment by Dick Slusher, that it would be advantageous given the phase noise in some of his lasers to kind of flip over to a code that has a large phase width distance just before he does readout with his lasers. Okay, but moving qubits is a fundamentally different operation and has a different noise characteristic than gate operations with laser read in and out. Okay. So there's one big problem though, okay? So gates can convert one class of error to another. Okay, we'll see an example of that on the next slide. So this greatly complicates kind of when I have collected my syndrome measurements and my error correction stage, kind of going back and making a prediction as to exactly what's happening with noise at the computation stage. Okay, and so it gets pretty complicated pretty quickly. So if I want to kind of predict what the next error correction block is going to see or need in terms of code distances, I have to take into account the gates that were in the previous stage, as well as kind of the anticipated gates, because I have this error conversion problem. And there's really kind of too many degrees of freedom floating around to, you know, accurately predict all of the statistics reliably. So you really have to make broad assumptions to reduce what I call the complexity of estimating the underlying error probability, looking at the syndromes and getting a good picture as to what errors are creeping in the computation. And so this is just an example of what I meant by the gate conversion. As we know, X, when it goes through the Hadamard, it gives us a Z. If I have an X error before a Hadamard, it shows up as a Z error after the Hadamard. And so, you know, if I have all of these, you know, whole gates and this big computational block, and I've got this error conversion and moving through gates, things get very messy. And so this is just a schematic. I can't possibly independently track probabilities of where errors are occurring in different parts of the circuit. But I can kind of make very broad-based, generalized assumptions, like on every wire or every transport of a qubit up to a gate, the probability of an X error here and here and here will all be the same, and the probability of a Z error occurring is going to all be the same. And with that kind of reduction in the number of degrees of freedom of my noise model within a computational block, I can make reasonable estimates as to the dynamics and the relative severity of the errors within the computation block. So this view graph just basically outlines what I just said before. If I assume that all of these probabilities are kind of equal here and the C there, then I can take the error syndrome and backtrack and back project and make a good estimate. And then I can use the error parameterization that I just determined plus gate information about the upcoming computational block to determine whether the current code that I'm using is adequate to protect the errors. So just to kind of to summarize this adaptive algorithm, what I'd like to do is go through and kind of pre-compile in some kind of a lookup table a bunch of good codes, okay? And it turns out that when you factor those polynomials into irreducible components and start playing games with assembling C alpha and C beta, I mean, sometimes you get a hit and you get very good bit width and face width distances, and sometimes you don't. And there's actually a relatively small subset of those combinations of those irreducible polynomials that lead to good codes. You don't want to kind of waste your time in real time figuring out which combinations of those irreducible polynomials gives you a good code. You have to kind of figure that out for your block length of interest and kind of have that pre-compiled and know what the fault tolerant gate instructions are that correspond to that and have that all ready to go. So if I end up in a scenario where I need more bit width distance but want to keep the block length the same, I kind of go to my lookup table and I have that option available to me. And then I make these generalizing assumptions and kind of make sure my next level is sufficiently protected and to basically do this, generalize assumptions, analyze the syndrome, and then implement the new code if I need to, hopefully not too often. So this was the kind of bang for the buck, a little bit, just a short brief table. So things are getting a little complicated. I'm compiling statistics. I'm feeding back, you know, what the kind of a measure of what the gates were from the previous block. I'm feeding back what a measure of what the gates are from an upcoming block. But these are all classical kind of computations that can be done pretty efficiently offline. And so the computational complexity of these isn't too bad. So hopefully the adaption will kind of track the overall error picture, and I'm shooting to really minimize the overall code length word and the number of syndromes measurement and the number of qubits per syndrome, and just to kind of give you a hand-waving flavor for improvements that you could kind of expect. I mean, if I find that I don't have any phase errors and I have some bit width errors, so I just need really a bit width code, I don't need a steam code, which has a phase width component. I mean, then I drop from number of syndromes from 6 to 2 and the number of qubits per syndrome from 4 to 2. So I get a pretty substantial bang for the buck trying to reduce the complexity. So just to conclude, adaptive techniques have just proven very, very useful classically. And I'm just trying to kind of draw over from the classical regime useful signal processing techniques. And we've seen universal gate sets, we've seen a lot of the coding ideas come over, and so hopefully some of these advanced schemes can also come over. But the benefit of it is that we can track time-varying noise and kind of optimize error correction. To some degree, we may be able to decouple the overall a priori design of our quantum computer. If we've got kind of a black box on error correction stage where we can say, look, this can handle a wide range of noise. I don't really have to be super paranoid about optimizing my error correction stage. I dump this adaptive block into the error correction stage, basically pre-compile enough degrees of freedom that I can work reliably well over the range of error that or noise that I expect. And so hopefully this would kind of ease the overall design process. And the overall goal, like I just mentioned before, is to kind of combine asymmetric codes and these adaptive error correction schemes to really minimize the resources and time that the quantum computer spends doing error correction and maximize the resources and time that it spends doing computation. Thank you.
How much overhead is incurred when you are changing your code word?
Yeah, I don't have detailed calculations. It's acceptable, but I don't really have numbers for you. Okay, I have a back of the envelope calculation that it's not going to be really easy and it's not going to be really hard. It's more in the middle. So sorry.
Just in your opinion, then the payoff is still there. But
yeah. Yeah.
Other questions?
Maybe I can suggest a good family of codes, which is the polynomial codes, formed from two classical Riesz-Hallman codes. Because one built-in parameter, which is, so you have you know, the bits of code, the phase code, have, you know, like, degrees which are n minus each other.
Right.
So that's the built-in property that adjusts the relative strength. The other thing is that it's really easy to move from one to the other. So you can do transversal control knots, and between codes different.
Can you do the transversal control knots easily between, you know, when you're updating in this picture?
What do you mean? Between, you can't certainly do transversal control knots between two arbitrary codes. So it's, they need, you know, some relationship between them. And you can only do it in one way.
Ratio of B be the same as ratio of probability? Well, I mean, not the
log. Well, so if the errors are relatively independent, you know, bit flip errors and phase flip errors within the circuit, I, you know, if I'm twice as likely to have a bit flip error as a phase flip error in a computational block, then I would kind of roughly need twice the distance for correcting bit flips as phase flips in the error correction stage. You're talking about the ratio of, like,
yeah,
D bit flip during divided by the D phase flip? Yeah, so the probability of a bit flip occurring, say, at a point within that computational block. Okay. We'll talk about it after the
Any other questions?
All
right, well, let's have a coffee break, and we're convening at 11:45. Let's take this people.